And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I suggest that you have a pencil and paper handy because you might want to write something down. There might be some piece of information, some date and time that you want to record so that you can take care of it later. And the first one might just be the California Native Plant Society Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team. Restoration is going to happen this Saturday, December 7th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park, just up the hill here. It's time to return to this sweet spot of a park, one of our county's crown jewels, the Sand Hills. I hope you're enjoying this wonderful fall weather, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed that some cold weather will bring winter showers that are very much needed, and it very well happen Friday night, Saturday morning. We will be starting up our yearly restoration efforts at the ranch, removing invasive non-native French broom. There will be lots of work repulling broom in multiple sites due to the persistent seed bank throughout the park. The Quail Hollow Ranch County Park is located in Felton. To get there, go up Graham Hill Road and turn left on East Ziandi Road. Then go about 2 miles up, making a left on Quail Hollow Road. The park entrance is about a half a mile up Quail Hollow Road on the right. Meet in the parking lot on the left. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80, wear comfortable clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. It might just be raining this Saturday morning, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring some gloves and some water. If you want more information, contact their program leader, Linda. Her phone number, 831-462-4041. That's 462-4041. Or you could email her at redwoodrn. That's R-E-D-W-D-R-N at pacbell.net. Or visit the website, www.cruzcnps.org. That's C-R-U-Z-C-N-P-S.org. And join us for a rally to save the Delta and Northern California rivers. It will be happening next Friday, December 13th at noon in Sacramento on the west steps of the state capitol. That's on the Capitol Mall at 10th between L and N streets in Sacramento. Please join Friends of the River and our partners for a rally at the state capitol to fight the proposed water tunnels under the Delta. Bring friends, family, and your neighbors to help show our united opposition to the governor's water tunnels. We expect this disastrous plan will be unveiled by state agencies on the morning of Friday, December 13th. This unprecedented water and land grab, given the misleading title of the Bay Delta Conservation Plan, should be called the Bay Delta and Rivers Destruction Plan. If these two huge $25 billion, 30-plus mile-long tunnels are approved and built, massive quantities of fresh water will be taken out of the Sacramento River before it reaches the Delta, only to be delivered to pumping plants in the Southland, further subsidizing corporate agriculture and runaway development. The water to fill these twin monstrosities will have to come from somewhere. We can kiss goodbye to flows from upstream reservoirs for fish preservation purposes. We can kiss goodbye to flows for anglers, rafters, and recreations. We can kiss goodbye to thousands of family farms, ranches, family homes, and recreational cabins along our rivers and reservoirs. We can kiss goodbye to 40-plus years of hard-fought and successful campaigns to preserve free-flowing rivers through both the state and national wild and scenic river acts. Moreover, the taxpayers, that means you and me, can kiss goodbye to hundreds of billions of dollars needed to build the legacy our governor wishes to leave us, his tunnel vision of completing his father's almost identical peripheral canal plan that was voted down by the voters in 1982. It is not possible to overstate the threat the tunnels were posed to all of our Northern California rivers and the river conservation battles won by you, our partners and friends of the river, since 1973. If we win this battle and stop the tunnels, plenty of other battles will remain for us to fight. But if we lose the battle over the tunnels, we may wind up losing not only the Delta, but also our cherished Northern California free-flowing rivers. Once again, that rally Friday, December 13th at noon on the west steps of the State Capitol building in Sacramento. That's on the Capitol Mall between at 10th Street between L and N. And if you want more information, go to www.friendsoftheriver.org. And here is the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. No buffalo have been killed by hunters since our last update. Temperatures have dropped into the negative numbers and snow has fallen. Hebgen Lake is now frozen, and the few wild buffalo that are in Montana are keeping themselves safe from hunters for now. In a spiteful move before a meeting of the Interagency Bison Management Plan, the Montana Department of Livestock has revealed shocking plans to harass, capture, vaccinate, and slaughter wild migratory buffalo in the Hebgen Basin west of Yellowstone National Park. The Montana Department of Livestock appears determined to proceed despite strong objections and oppositions from the National Park Service, the Nez Perce Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes, the Intertribal Buffalo Council, and the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Department. The only interagency bison management plan agency supporting the Montana Department of Livestock's move was the Federal Livestock Overseer, USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, who is now funding the Montana Department of Livestock's project with your federal tax dollars. Please go to our website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, to take action on this issue. We want to thank you in advance for taking the time to raise your voice for America's last wild buffalo. Please spread the word to save these herds. And volunteers are needed. Please, if you even have a week or two to spare, we would be so grateful for your help. We have a great crew, and the small numbers create a fun, close-knit spirit. We also have, or, well, I guess they've already had their awesome harvest feast. If you can help out, please email or call our volunteer coordinators as soon as possible at volunteer@buffalofieldcampaign.org or phone 406-646-0070. But if you can't make it in person, please make a donation or send some merchandise along in support of our work. As a grassroots nonprofit comprised of the most dedicated people you'll ever meet, every little bit goes a long, long way. And I know because I was there during the late summer, and they were already busy cutting firewood, and that was in early September. You know, winter comes early in Montana. Anyway, the Buffalo Field Campaign, their P.O. Box is 957 West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. Their phone number, 406-646-0070, on the webpage that has all this information and more, is at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And please remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And pilot whales are heading back to sea after beaching in Florida, in this story reported by Jane Sutton, edited by Andre Grenon and Grant McCool, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Most of the pilot whales that were stranded in the Florida Everglades swam into deeper water today, while rescuers tried to chase the rest out to sea by banging on pipes and revving their boat engines. Wildlife workers had hoped the cacophony would encourage the whales to leave the shallow water where dozens of short-finned pilot whales were first sighted on Tuesday afternoon in a remote part of the Everglades National Park. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, said via Twitter that of the 51 whales originally stranded, 11 have died. Five went missing overnight on Wednesday. NOAA said that 35 swimming away were about 9 miles from shore in about 18 feet of water with about 10 or 15 miles to go before they reached deeper water. Biologists were collecting samples from some of the carcasses in hopes of learning how they died. There were also sharks in the area feeding on the carcasses of the dead whales, NOAA said. Biologists said the beached whales often re-beach and that survival rates in mass strandings were very low. About 36 would-be rescuers from NOAA, the National Park Service, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, and police set out in boats for the rescue effort while the Coast Guard tracked them from the air. The Coast Guard cutter crew is also enforcing a safety zone to protect the whales and keep sightseers away. Quote, a lot of people may have good intentions of helping them and do more harm than good, Coast Guard Chief Petty Officer Ryan Doss said. Pilot whales live in tightly cohesive groups and typically will not leave ailing or dead members behind. They are a deep water species that forages on squid, octopus, and fish and cannot live long in shallow, warm waters. And the first prosecution of a wind company has taken place for killing birds. The United States Department of Justice announced a settlement on the prosecution of Duke Energy's wind developments in Wyoming in connection with the deaths of 14 golden eagles and 149 other protected birds. And that amounted to $1 million in fines and mitigation actions. This is the first prosecution of a wind company in connection with bird mortality. Quote, this is a welcome action by the Department of Justice and one that we have long anticipated, said Dr. George Fenwick, president of the American Bird Conservancy, a longtime advocate for stronger federal management of the wind industry. Wind energy is not green if it is killing hundreds of thousands of birds. We are pro-wind and pro-alternative energy, but development needs to be bird smart. The unfortunate reality is that the flagrant violations of the law seen in this case are widespread, according to Dr. Fenwick. This enforcement action is the first and only time a line in the sand has been drawn by the government, said Dr. Michael Hutchins, coordinator of the American Bird Conservancy's National Bird Smart Wind Energy Campaign. Quote, the boundaries for the wind industry are voluntary, meaning that companies have been able to pay lip service to bird protection laws and then largely do what they want. Poorly sited wind projects exist or are planned that clearly ignore the advice of federal and state biologists who have few, if any, means of preventing them from going ahead, unquote. The charges stem from the discovery of 14 golden eagles and 149 other protected birds, including hawks, blackbirds, larks, wrens, and sparrows, by the company at its Campbell Hill and Top of the World wind projects in Converse County, Wyoming, between 2009 and 2013. The two wind projects comprise 176 large wind turbines sited on private agricultural land. The American Bird Conservancy has called for the prosecution of wind companies over violations of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Acts on various occasions, including requests to Congress and officials of both the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Department of Justice. Quote, all wind projects kill some birds. It is sadly unavoidable, but some areas are worse than others, and we can predict where many of these will be, unquote, said Hutchins. Quoting, the problem with the Duke Energy wind facilities in Wyoming is very similar to problems that exist elsewhere. Wind farms are being built without adequate plans to mitigate and compensate for bird impacts, unquote. The American Bird Conservancy has developed a risk assessment map to provide general guidance on siting, though it is not a replacement for project-specific environmental assessments. Wind projects in lower-risk areas are likely to be less expensive to mitigate and compensate for through programs such as habitat banking. The Department of Energy in 2010 published a renewable energy plan for the United States that called for a 12-fold increase in wind-generating capacity by the year 2030. In 2009, the wind industry was estimated to be killing about 440,000 birds. In 2012, a new estimate by Dr. Sean Smallwood suggested that it was killing closer to 600,000 birds. Quote, killing 500,000 birds by today's wind industry is a significant figure, but how many more will be killed when the country has fully built out a program 12 times larger that operates without strong siting or operating guidelines, unquote, asked Hutchins. Requoting, the wind industry should be treated like any other for-profit energy industries. We believe it's necessary to enforce development restrictions on wind, such as avoiding bird migration corridors and places where protected species and sensitive habitats are present, unquote. If you'd like more information, go to www.abcbirds.org. That's www.abcbirds.org. And a cruel English badger cull meets an embarrassing end in this story by Alicia Graff at care2.com. Two controversial Badger culls have been labeled as failures and finally been stopped after it became clear that those going after them wouldn't be able to kill enough badgers to meet their targets. While this has led to relief among animal advocates, it also raises concerns that what was done will make things worse. The pilot programs were run in Gloucestershire and Somerset in an effort to stop the spread of bovine tuberculosis among cattle, but killing badgers to solve the problem has caused controversy among scientists, farmers, the government, and animal advocates. The programs were designed to see whether or not shooting free-running badgers at night, as opposed to trapping them, would help stop the spread of bovine tuberculosis. Scientists and animal advocacy groups, including the Badger Trust, Humane Society International of the United Kingdom, the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, the League Against Cruel Sports, and the International Fund for Animal Welfare, among others, have all come out strongly opposing the badgers as scapegoats for a problem affecting cattle. Concerns weren't only raised about the cruelty inherent in shooting badgers and about the possibility of leaving many wounded to die slowly from their injuries, but also about whether or not it would even be effective. According to one significant study, the randomized badger culling trial, badger culling can make no meaningful contribution to cattle tuberculosis control in Britain. It also concluded that weak testing for cattle keep them contributing significantly to the problem, and that scientific findings indicate that the rising incidence of disease can be reversed and geographical spread contained by the rigid application of cattle-based control measures alone. Unfortunately, science wasn't enough to stop the culls from starting last month. Natural England granted a 8-week extension to the cull in Gloucestershire after marksmen failed to meet their target goal of 70% of the population, but the whole thing was shut down after they failed to even meet a reduced goal during the extension. The cull in Somerset also failed to meet its target despite a 3-week extension there. According to the Telegraph, Natural England said the cull was ended because there was, quote, no realistic prospect of the cull removing the number of badgers required by the license, unquote. While the cruelty and effectiveness were questioned to begin with, the failure to meet their target goal in the set time period raises serious questions about where all these troublesome badgers are and about the government's ability to run these programs effectively and humanely. Not only have millions of pounds been spent to senselessly kill hundreds of badgers, but many are now concerned that the badgers who were left will disperse and potentially spread the disease to new areas, while others will move in to fill their place, which will both cause more problems. Quote, I am much relieved the government's badger cull fiasco is finally over, for the time being at least. We hope the government will now do the decent thing and admit that killing badgers to control tuberculosis in cattle is a ludicrous and inhumane idea, unquote. Mark Jones, executive director of the Humane Society International of the United Kingdom, told The Guardian. According to the League Against Cruel Sports, even though the culls have ended, the government is still planning on running them for the next 3 years and starting them in other areas. The organization also raised concerns about findings that the government has considered gassing badgers, even though that was banned in 1982 because it's considered inhumane. If you'd like to take action on this issue or other issues, please go to www.care2.com. That's C-A-R-E, the number 2, .com. And the tide is turning on one of front of Africa's war against rhino poachers in this story by Ed Stoddard, with editing by Michael Roddy and Mark Heinrich, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. New infantry-style tactics of concealment and ambush by armed park rangers are credited with turning the tide in the war against poachers of the endangered and rhino on one front in South Africa's Madikwe Game Reserve. The slaughter of rhinos, a creature regarded as an icon of African wildlife for their horns to meet soaring demand in Asia, has raised alarm bells among conservationists. Since April, Madikwe rangers, previously so under-equipped that they lacked even boots, have been undergoing military training overseen by former British Special Forces soldiers. They have been kitted out with state-of-the-art gear provided by the Chikowitz Family Foundation, a charity that supports anti-poaching initiatives on the African continent. The numbers suggest this strategy is working. Since the training started in April, we have not lost a rhino that we know of, said Declan Hoffmeyer, chief of operations in Medikwe. To be precise, the last rhino known to have been poached in the park was on April 6th, more than 200 days ago, a remarkable turn of events given the onslaught that had been taking place. Poachers have gunned down rhinos indiscriminately to meet demand from newly affluent economies in Asia, notably Vietnam and China, where the animal's horn is highly prized as a crucial ingredient in traditional medicines. At $65,000 a kilogram, about 2.2 pounds, rhino horn on the streets of major Asian cities is now more valuable than gold or platinum. South Africa, which is home to the vast majority of the world's rhinos, has become the epicenter of the slaughter. Last year, the 680 square kilometer, about 260 square mile Wadikwe, lost 18 rhinos to poachers, a dramatic surge from 2011 when only two were slain. In the first 3.5 months of this year, a further 9 rhinos were killed in the park for their horns. Then the killing stopped in Medikwe, while the toll has continued to rise in the rest of South Africa. According to government data, as of November 6th, 825 rhino had been poached in South Africa in 2013, compared to 668 for all of last year. If the trend stays at its current pace, more than 1,000 rhinos would be killed in 2014, putting the roughly 22,000 animals in South Africa on the brink of a population decline. The rangers in Medikwe, mostly rural Africans drawn from the region, have bushcraft skills and a rich knowledge of flora and fauna, honed from lifetimes spent in the rough countryside. But their equipment was shoddy and they had no military training, putting them at a distinct disadvantage when confronted by well-armed poachers backed by international organized crime syndicates. Ex-British Army soldier Alan Ives, who has been overseeing their training, told Reuters, "It's easier to make a soldier out of a ranger than it is to take a trained soldier and teach them about the African bush," unquote. The Medikwe rangers now have scopes mounted to their rifles and torches or flashlights for night patrols, along with other equipment upgrades. This does not mean that they are cowboys rushing out to shoot to kill. South Africa does not officially have such a policy, but the training and firearms improvements are seen as potential deterrents to poachers. Some of the rangers previously didn't even have boots and showed up for patrols in jeans. "Not all of us had boots before. I used to bring my own, but they were too tight for me. I couldn't even walk 3 kilometers without taking a rest," said 26-year-old Given Nitmane. The military has been deployed elsewhere in South Africa to tackle the rhino poaching problem, such as in the Israel-sized Kruger National Park, where Special Forces soldiers have also joined the ranks of park rangers. The success of such tactics in Medikwe compared to Kruger, which has lost 500 rhinos so far this year and counting, may come down to size and geography. At almost 200,000 square kilometers, Kruger is nearly 40 times the size of Medikwe, and even putting 40 times the number of boots on the ground there may not help that much, because it is wilderness areas are so remote and so far off the beaten track. Kruger also has a 350-kilometer longer border with Mozambique, one of the world's poorest countries where rural villages are often densely populated, providing plenty of recruits for the lucrative business of rhino poaching. Medikwe, by contrast, shares a border with sparsely populated and relatively affluent Botswana. Still, the Medikwe success could be rolled out elsewhere in the country if donor or state funds are made available. And turning to news of biological diversity, sage grouse have 1.8 million more acres of habitat to be protected. The charismatic greater sage grouse, known for its male's smooth moves at mating time, may now have something really to dance about. After years of work by the Center for Biological Diversity, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed Endangered Species Act protection, plus 1.8 million acres of protected critical habitat for sage grouse in the Mono Basin area of California and Nevada. This bi-state population of grouse is geographically isolated and genetically distinct from others and threatened by habitat destruction via livestock grazing, invasive weeds, development, and off-road vehicles. The Center for Biological Diversity and its allies petitioned for this bird in 2005. 5 years later, it became a candidate for protection. The recent proposal was required under the center's 2011 historic agreement, speeding up decisions for 757 imperiled species, under which more than 100 species have been protected to date. It's also a precursor to protection for greater sage-grouse across the entire West, with that decision slated for the year 2015. And 15 Hawaiian plants and animals have gotten life-saving help. The center's 757 agreement with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service also yielded Endangered Species Act protection for 7 species on the island of Hawaii and another 8 Hawaiian species which fall prey to similar threats won safeguards as well. The newly protected species are 13 plants, a picture wing fly, and an ultra-rare pool shrimp, of which only 5 individuals have ever been directly observed. The 13 plants include sunflowers, asters, and trees with such sonorous Hawaiian names as Kukulawa, Haha, Aku, Haiwale, and Uhi Uhi. They're threatened by a host of forces, including development, destruction by feral goats and pigs, and extreme weather. 4 of the 13 have been deemed rarest of the rare by the Plant Extinction Prevention Program. Each has fewer than 50 individuals surviving in the wild. The fly, discovered in 1968, lays its eggs only on the stems of Charpentiera plants and is being hurt by predation from exotic wasps, among other things. And the pool shrimp lives only on the Big Island, in landlocked bodies of water with underground connections to the sea, where siltation is harming the algae, bacteria, and small invertebrates it feeds on. One of the most primitive shrimp species in the world, this intriguing animal can only swim forward. Most shrimp can also swim backwards. The service is expected to publish a rule protecting critical habitat for the species soon. And 5 rare South American birds have won safeguards after decades. Back in 1980, a group of bird biologists petitioned to protect dozens of brilliantly colored, festively feathered, remarkably adapted, or just plain beautiful birds around the world under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. That petition didn't get very far very fast, nor did one following it 11 years later. But now, after decades of legal work by the center and allies, most of the original 73 birds petitioned have been protected. All these birds are special and rare. Each, like the gorgeted wood quail, of which only 500 remain, is treasured in its region. And now each will be better protected from trade, receive more funding for international conservation, and be paid heed when U.S. interests propose a project in its habitat. And we want to thank the Center for Biological Diversity at www.biologicaldiversity.org for their updates. I want to thank you for listening to the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz and is a production of Earth First Radio. If you'd like to listen to this broadcast again, you may do so tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, or next Monday evening at 9:30 on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, Idaho, 90.3 FM on their new high power channel. You can also go to radio4all.net. That's radio, the number 4all.net, where you can download or listen to a podcast of this show. And we'd like you to tune in next Thursday evening right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz for another edition of the Earth First Update. Thank you very much for listening.